if anyone is listening to this thinking, can I make it work? I don't know. Is it a really huge, scary commitment? I mean, I think it is a big commitment, but it doesn't have to be forever. You know, I'm often asked, well, is that it? You know, are you going to homeschool her until she's 16 or 18? And the answer is, I have no idea.
Another episode of What She Said. In this week's episode, which again, I think it's a good 3 weeks since I released the last episode. I'm being very sporadic with them. I apologise, but such is life. In this week's episode, I chat to Eloise Rickman. Eloise is an educator, a doula, qualified doula, and an author. Brand new author. So Eloise's book Extraordinary Parenting came out really recently, and we talk about the very quick process to get that out, and we just take a deep dive into parenting, home education, the problems with various models of education. I hope you enjoy it. I really loved talking to Eloise. She's so interesting. If you liked it, please let us know over on Instagram. As ever, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts, share it with your friends if you think anyone would benefit from it. Actually, just share it regardless, just as a gift to me. And if you want to come over to Patreon to join the community, it's patreon.com/LucyLucraft. Thank you to all of my Patreons for making this podcast happen. You are gold. Enjoy the episode. I know. Thank goodness. So I have known you for a little while now and lived in your world for a while. I've done quite a few of your courses, but for anybody, and I'm also about three quarters of the way through your book, I'm not a fast reader, so that's a testament to how brilliant the book is. For anybody who doesn't know you, Eloise, introduce yourself.
So my name is Eloise Rickman. I live in South London with my husband Sam and our daughter Frieda. And Frieda is 5 and she is home educated. So she's never been to school. She's never been to nursery. She's kind of been at home since day one. And I am a parent educator. So I work with parents around the world through online courses and private coaching. And I'm also a writer. And as of a few weeks ago, an author. And I've just published my first book, Extraordinary Parenting. So yeah, I'm delighted to be on here.
Oh, I'm so excited to talk to you. So first of all, let's talk about the book, because I know how it happened and was, yeah, blown away by the speed of everything. But tell everyone how it happened.
So for some context, we are at the time of recording still in a COVID pandemic. And so I started writing the book a few months ago, and it was the kind of mid-March when we had all been told by our Prime Minister, you know, you need to stay at home and we're going to close for schools. And at this point, I was really feeling quite torn as to, okay, how does, as somebody who works with parents, I was getting so many messages and emails and seeing so many parents out there feeling quite lost. But I was also seeing a huge amount, I don't know if you felt this, but so much kind of online noise. You know, there were so many, and, you know, they were good, but it felt quite overwhelming. So many emails, so many blog posts, so many podcasts, so many kind of Instagram lives around parenting and homeschooling. And personally, at the time, I felt very much like, I want to spend less time on my phone at the moment rather than more time. I felt like my phone was making me very anxious, because you know, you couldn't turn the thing on without hearing another horror story about the COVID crisis. So I did quite a lot of digging and thinking, okay, well, I really want to try and show up for my clients and my community and do something useful, but I really don't want to put out kind of yet another blog post series or, you know, another set of YouTube videos or something. And I am somebody who likes books a lot. That's kind of my go-to if I want to learn something or if I want to escape or, you know, whatever it is, I tend to return to, okay, I need a book for this. And so I thought, well, really, I think parents need a book to kind of help them through this crisis, because although there are so many amazing parenting books out there, You know, I've read kind of hundreds of them, and there are some fantastic books out there that have really changed my perspective on parenting and, had a huge influence on my life as a mother and as a person. So many of them, when you read them in the context of the big changes which have happened over the past few months, they don't seem irrelevant, but they felt slightly out of touch with what was happening. And so I was in the bath, which is where I do all my thinking, because you can't have your phone in the bath and you can't have other people in the bath. You can, but I try and lock the door. And I just thought, oh, I wonder if I could just write a book on this, kind of on peaceful parenting and sort of home education, but within the context, not just of COVID, but I think, you know, we're seeing so many changes and so much uncertainty anyway at the moment. And I think we've always had to live with uncertainty as humans, you know, and I don't think our generation in that respect is any different. You know, we've had generations scared of wars and, you know, scared of atomic weapons and so on. But I do think that the changes are happening quite rapidly at the moment. And I think that we do, so many of us sort of live with this threat of uncertainty hanging over us a lot of the time. So I wanted to write a book which would help parents, not just through the COVID crisis, but through any form of uncertainty, whilst really helping them feel more grounded in their parenting, I suppose. So I spoke to my agent and said to her, you know, I have no idea how fast these things can happen, but what if I were to write a book? And she said, well, you know, very occasionally publishers can kind of crash publish things and bring them out really quickly. I think there might be some appetite. Shall we explore it? And she was amazing. And within 4 days, we had a couple of different publishers who were interested. And I had quite optimistically put, yeah, I can turn the book around in 2 weeks, because I'd already been doing lots of research and thinking, because in my mind, I was going to write a slightly different book, which is why things were already set up and I already had an agent. And so I had already quite a lot of material that I knew I could draw on. But then publishers came back and said, yeah, we'd love it. Give us your book in 2 weeks.
Oh, goodness.
So my husband was amazing and really stepped up. And yeah, here we are now. So we got it. It normally takes, I think, about 2 years to turn the book around. And my amazing publishers managed to do it in just under 2 months. So it's been quite a whirlwind. But yeah, it's super exciting to hear people like you actually reading it. And I don't know, it feels quite surreal that something I've wanted to do for so long has just sort of happened in this way. But it feels very cool. I feel very, very grateful.
I think it's so natural for you to be writing books, because I really remember one of the very first kind of stories that I remember watching, Instagram stories that I remember watching of yours. You'd said you had a big pile of books and it was a work day, and you said, I sometimes think that my job is to read books so that parents don't have to. Yeah. And I don't know why, but that particular thing has always stuck with me.
Mm.
That I think when, so I've done three of your courses, and that is very much the sense that I get when I'm digesting the courses, is that I'm digesting the courses and about a gazillion books that have gone into your brain to create the course. And although I'm not saying that you're, you know, like a Blinkist, you don't paraphrase the books, you don't plagiarize the books. What I mean is that I can very much see the kind of family tree, as it were, the book family tree.
Yeah, I feel like it's such an amazing job to be able to do, to be honest. And it's interesting because I haven't always done this work. Before I had Frida, my daughter, I was a senior press officer for a government department. And actually it feels like, although they feel on the surface like they're quite, you know, polar worlds apart, actually it feels like so much of what I did then, you know, reading reports or speaking to policy officials and then speaking to government ministers in terms of being like, okay, this is what you need to say in your interview, or the other way around, kind of, you know, taking all of this stuff from the department and talking about it succinctly to press officers. It feels like there's a lot of that which kind of uses the same skills. So it's interesting seeing how that has evolved in terms of a career.
So talk to me about homeschooling. So you were homeschooled for a little bit, weren't you?
Yeah, just a couple.
So why? Sorry, go on.
No, just I was going to say just a couple of years. So just until I was 6 and a half. So in the UK, I was homeschooled for nursery up to year one. And then I went into school in year two.
So why did you decide to do it with Frieda? And did you ever think that you'd be the type of person to do it? Because, I mean, based on your background, I'm guessing it wasn't a wild decision to make. But I think so many of us who come to decide to home educate actually are kind of going against the caricature in our heads of a homeschooling parent. I don't know if you think the same way.
Yeah, I think there is definitely a strong caricature around homeschooling parents, which is sometimes true,
you know, for sure.
But I think for me, it almost felt like quite a natural decision. I feel supremely lucky, and I talk about this in the book a little bit at the start, to have had those few years at home with my parents. And I feel like it's kind of a cliche, but, you know, they really were not money rich at all. They were quite poor when I was a young child, but I felt like my childhood was incredibly rich because, you know, it was very idyllic. We went to the beach every day. We grew up in Brighton, where you are now. In fact, I think my mum lives a few streets away from you, which is really fun. So, you know, we went to the beach every day. We went to the park every day. You know, I saw my grandparents a lot. They were the only holidays we had. But it felt like, you know, I had everything I needed. We didn't have loads of money and loads of toys, but we had the library and there was a toy library. And yeah, I felt like my childhood was incredibly rich. And I feel like, although I did then go to school, I feel like when I started school, I was kind of streets ahead academically, I suppose, just because I had had all of that time just one-on-one. And so even though I then just went through very normal state schools, it then, I feel, gave me a really strong boost, which kind of helped me all the way through my school time, I suppose. And yeah, I feel like it also, not just academically, but gave me a lot of confidence in terms of myself and gave me a strong sense of kind of self-worth, which I feel has been really, really valuable. And it's something I haven't really reflected on very much. And then when I had a child myself, you suddenly start seeing all of these parallels. And so, yeah, when it was time for me to return back to work, I found that increasingly I really just didn't want to go. I had a lot of kind of, you know, crying and feeling increasingly like, oh, this isn't really the childhood that I had, and this isn't really the childhood I want to give my daughter. And, you know, I think it's worth highlighting as well that this is an incredibly privileged position to be in, to even be having those conversations, because I know a lot of families would probably love to not have to return to work and love to be able to home educate, and they just can't financially. So it is an enormous privilege. But yeah, my husband and I sat down, and I think he was not home educated at all. He was in nursery at a young age and then went to school, you know, all throughout. But actually he, for kind of, I guess, almost opposite reasons, was equally keen to home educate. I sometimes think that he is even more of a proponent of home education than I am, which makes it much easier. I speak to a lot of people who would love to homeschool and their partners are really against it. So I think then that's a big privilege to have a partner who is naturally just really on board with it. But I think we kind of just thought, well, you know, it feels to us like a positive decision rather than a negative decision. So rather than thinking we don't want to send her to school because we think schools are terrible, I think actually there are a lot of amazing teachers out there who do a really good job. I just feel like it's a system and it's an institution, and no matter how amazing the teachers she has are, they're never going to love her as much as we are, and they're never going to be as invested in her joy and in her happiness and in her unique personality as we are. And it just felt like if we can give her a childhood where she gets to kind of explore at her own pace and, you know, spend more time outdoors and do more of the things that she is interested in, then why wouldn't we? And I think as well, you know, I know it is, again, very much a cliche, but childhood really does whiz past. And it sounds corny. I really enjoy spending time with her. I really enjoy being a mum. And, you know, it's not the only thing I want to do, but I really enjoy the time I get to spend with her. And I think I would also feel quite sad if I handed her over to a school 5 days a week. So at the moment, it works really well for us. And we're fortunate enough that we've kind of been able to be flexible in our work. So my husband works as a researcher for a university, and his work have been flexible too. So we've been able to make it work. And it's not at all something I take for granted. But yeah, it is kind of the dream, being able to both work and do it. So yeah, if anyone is listening to this thinking, can I make it work? I don't know. Is it a really huge, scary commitment? I mean, I think it is a big commitment, but it doesn't have to be forever. You know, I'm often asked, well, is that it? You know, are you going to homeschool her until she's 16 or 18? And the answer is, I have no idea. I mean, I would be very happy to do so, but she may have other plans at some point. You know, if she turns around to me when she's 11 and says, I really, really, really want to go to school, then, you know, at some point you have to listen to your child, right? That's the whole point of homeschooling. You want to, to respect your child's wishes. So, you know, if she said that to me tomorrow, I would probably still say no, because she's only five. But certainly as she gets older, I think if she was really keen on trying, I think we would try and facilitate that for her.
Yeah, that's certainly how I feel too. I there was a couple of things that I wanted to pick out there that you were talking about. So in terms of teachers, and yes, there are brilliant teachers out there, of course there are, and it's very similar to politicians in many ways, that they, I do believe that fundamentally the majority of politicians go into politics at grassroots level because they want to help people and they think that they can. The problem is ultimately the system.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter how great a teacher you are, you are still working within, to my mind, a very, very flawed system. It's best of a bad job is what it's going to be, really. And I'm not saying no child is going to have a great time at school. My husband had a great time at school. He loved it. But which is the kind of the opposite of the experience that I had. But it's still a capitalist system that, to my mind, is teaching children to do the opposite of what will serve them.
Definitely. And I think the world has changed so much as well, you know, in terms of the kind of jobs that we now do and the kind of challenges that we face as a society. And I don't think school has caught up with it really at all. But even, you know, thinking less about kids' futures and more about just children now in the present, you know, I think that with what we know about how children learn and what children need to be happy and healthy, you know, for example, one of the big things that we know is that children need to be spending more time outside. Children aren't spending enough time outside, and children aren't spending enough time in kind of free play. And we know this, and other countries have managed to do this successfully. I know it's, again, an enormous cliche to roll out talking about Scandinavia. I think there's a reason we always talk about Scandinavian school systems, which is that, you know, actually, for example, children in Finland are super happy. They do really well academically, and they don't start any sort of formal schooling until they're 6 or 7. And they spend loads of time just outdoors playing. There's not a competitive nature. They don't do any exams until right at the end of their school time, when they do one set of exams and that's it. Whereas if you compare that to how our system is here in the UK, children are pitted against each other from day one. Children are compared, they're contrasted, they're ranked, they're observed. I don't think any human flourishes in that kind of environment. I certainly wouldn't. You know, if I was to choose an environment where I worked in now, you know, I wouldn't be able to bear it if people said, right, I'm going to take every single person who is a parenting author and writer, and I'm going to rank you all, and I'm going to compare you all, and you're all going to compete. There's only going to be a certain amount of levels. You know, even the fact that, for example, you know, grades are moderated, so you can't have everyone doing the same. You know, by default, some people have to do better and some people have to do worse. And I think you're right, though, when you talk about it being a system. And I think, yeah, that there are teachers who are doing an amazing job trying to push back against it.
Yeah, that's exactly it, isn't it?
It's just not a system. You know, I felt, and it's the same with every institution, I think. Mm. No institution, although it's there for a good reason. You know, it's the same with our NHS. It's the same with, you know, any kind of big institution that you have. You know, we're seeing this hugely at the moment with institutions like the police. You know, yes, you can have some good people in there, but fundamentally, I think so many institutions, it's just so difficult to have, you know, oversight and have a big institution which works well at every level for the people that it is trying to serve. And yeah, I think, again, this is why I feel very privileged to be able to kind of opt out of it, but I feel like an institution is probably not the best place for a young child to grow, to develop, and to do all the things that young children need to do.
Yeah, I completely agree. And respect to you for pointing out that to opt out of something like this is a privilege. And I wanted to talk a little bit about privilege within radical education. So the podcast I released, what day are we, Sunday, a couple of days ago, Friday, I talked to Lucy Aitken-Reed, who was also in your book, Lulastic and the Hippie Shake. Anyway, she is just incredible. And I talked to her about, I think the question that I asked her was, you know, I think some of the criticisms of, we were talking specifically about unschooling, and some of the criticisms are that, you know, it is kind of very privileged, a bit elite. And actually, you know, she pointed out that by me saying it was elite, I actually am erasing the hard work of marginalized folk who are doing it at the risk of their own comfort and safety, which is absolutely right, because there are people within radical education movements, not just unschooling or just radical parenting, who are doing it not just like you or I, who are doing it against kind of the status quo and perhaps to a few raised eyebrows. It's, you know, it's not safe for them, because for context, obviously Anais is not at official school age, so it doesn't really matter what I do with her. Nobody's asking me questions, but once she gets to Frida's age, I will have to do official things to prove to the state that I'm educating her, which is what obviously you're having to do now. For you or I, you as a white woman, me as a white passing woman, cis women, this is a different conversation than for a single parent or a black woman or for a trans woman or for any, you know, a queer woman, and you know, any of these. Well, I can also include men, but so this is a very different conversation. And I wonder, for those of us with, you know, at the top of the kind of privilege tower, how can we be making these radical spaces that we move in safe, open, diverse?
And it's such a good question. And I think what you raise as well is interesting, the fact that when you get to 5 here in the UK, this is the time when you become compulsory school age. And so we haven't had any contact with our local authority because Frida's never been in school. So I think you don't, at the moment, the law is that you don't have to register as a homeschooler until, unless that your child has been in school and then you've deregistered them.
I see.
She knows that we homeschool Frida, and I'm not opposed to anyone knowing, but because it's not compulsory. So what our local council says, they have, you know, a home education officer. They say, you know, please do reach out. But I had a long conversation with one of my friends actually about this very subject, because I said to her, well, look, do you think that, you know, it's better for me, as you say, somebody who has a huge amount of privilege, to reach out to our local home education officer and talk to her about home education? Because I think they probably see a lot of children who have been taken out of school because their experience of school has not been positive. And they probably see far fewer sort of, I don't know, intentional homeschoolers. So people who are starting out with the vision of home educating. So I was saying to her, you know, do you think that it's worth me contacting her, even though it then means that our name is on a file and we might have to have more intrusive visits in order to kind of make the case for homeschooling more generally? And she was like, well, you know, I think that's an interesting idea and I can see how there might be positives from that. But she was like, you also need to think about, you know, the fact that the way you home educate, and we do take a very relaxed, quite a child-led approach, but, you know, we also do things which are probably seen as very kind of traditional in terms of academics. You know, Frida is really interested in maths, so we do lots of maths with her. We're lucky that we live in a house with a garden with lots of books. You know, my husband teaches her coding and stuff. We do philosophy with her, you know, and it's all stuff that we do because she enjoys it and we enjoy it. But she was like, how do you think it would feel if someone comes over to your house, you know, a council officer, and they see that you've got books in kind of French and Latin and, you know, then they think, oh, you know, this is very good. And then they see another family the next day who maybe doesn't have some of these privileges. And they've got you in the back of their mind as someone who is doing home education right. And maybe they meet a family who is, you know, a Black family who's homeschooling in a much more unschooling way, and they live in a flat. And she was saying, you know, how will that, do you think your perspective will encourage the council officer to be more open-minded or less? And I think it really has made me think a lot about that question of, okay, how do you use your privilege? So I reflected a lot after our conversation, and I thought, okay, you know what, I'm actually not gonna, I think that she was probably right. I think there's probably no one right answer, but I felt very strongly, okay, I don't want to be helping prop up expectations of homeschooling that perhaps won't serve other families. And I haven't actually listened to your conversation with Lucy yet, but I am really excited to do so because I adore her work. And I do think that unschooling is something which probably takes a lot more. Like you say, you know, it's not to say that other families aren't doing it, but I think it probably takes a lot more courage and risks a lot more for certain families to be taking that approach. So I do, it is something I wonder about a lot. And I think not just in homeschooling as well, but in terms of education in general, I think, you know, opting out, like I was saying before, and taking your child out of that system is a huge privilege to be able to do so. But I also wonder sometimes about the fact that, well, if my daughter went to the local school, all this energy that I'm pouring into educating her, you know, would I be pouring some of that energy into trying to raise money for the school, or on being on the PTA, or, you know, trying to, you know, help support a wider community? And again, I don't think there's a clear cut answer, but something that increasingly, I don't know, I'm thinking about is, can we have more of a, it feels like there's such a barrier between schooled communities and homeschooled communities. And it feels like starting to break down some of these barriers and labels would probably help everyone, because, and I think that would probably help more marginalized people within homeschool communities as well. But I mean, I think living in London, we probably have a slightly different picture of homeschooling than perhaps we would in other places. So before lockdown started, I started meeting up kind of semi-regularly with a group of very local homeschoolers to me. I was delighted when somebody set something up. And, you know, just thinking about our immediate group, you know, there's maybe 5, 6, 7 core people. Actually, it's quite a diverse group in terms of probably, you know, race and probably background. And, you know, some have had their children in school and taking them out. Some have been kind of intentionally homeschooling from the start. So I feel very lucky in terms of, you know, we have, I think, in London, quite a diverse community of homeschoolers. But it definitely, you know, all of the conversations that we have rightly been having recently, I think, and, you know, for lots of people longer, around, okay, how do we ensure that we are not just homeschoolers, but we are anti-racist homeschoolers who are really trying to think about what we're teaching our children, both in terms of curriculums, but also in terms of our own actions and values. It's really, again, making me think, okay, how do I ensure that these groups are even more inclusive? And I think there are certain things that homeschoolers can do. So, you know, meeting up in places which are easy to get to by public transport, which are free as well. You know, there are certain things which are accessible in terms of, you know, if someone is coming in a wheelchair. I think there are certain things that should, you know, it sounds quite obvious when I'm saying them, but I think they should be a no-brainer to start off with. You know, is this, what if you're having a book club or something as part of your homeschooling, and we haven't done anything like that yet, but, you know, again, are you reading books which kind of center diverse voices? But I think there needs to be more conversation more widely in the homeschooling community. I think a lot of homeschooling leaders, especially I think in the US, because I'm a bit behind the US at the moment in the UK in terms of big homeschooling groups and conferences and things. But I know that, you know, a lot of the voices in the homeschooling community, and I can, you know, add myself into that as well, are white and are coming at home education from a white perspective. And I think we really need to be aware of that and to lift up other diverse voices as well, or we're never going to get a community that feels truly inclusive. And I think that is a, you know, that harms everyone.
Totally. And actually, at this point, I just want to signpost the listeners to the Conscious Kid, who have an Instagram, which is free, but also a Patreon, which I would encourage you to sign up for if you can spare the cash, because they produce a heap of anti-racist content to help you teach your children to be anti-racist, how to model anti-racism for your children. And yeah, it's just invaluable. So I wanted to jump in, and actually this is probably the good time to do it, and talk about some of the issues with the different home education approaches. So in your courses, you're really honest about some of the issues with things like Waldorf Steiner and Charlotte Mason, which I know is not, there's not as many people going for Charlotte Mason in the UK as the US, right? But I guess it's kind of growing. So how do you reconcile those issues with your own kind of radically compassionate values?
I think it's about, like you say at the beginning, being honest, like laying all of our cards on a table and really looking at these different philosophies for what they are. So I think Waldorf is a really good one. And I've seen actually some really amazing and inspiring accounts on Instagram recently. I was actually staying up really late last night reading through. I can't remember for the life of me what it was called now. I don't have my phone in front of me. But it was an account by people who used to attend specifically one Steiner school in New York. And they were all sharing their experiences anonymously of being black and brown and people of colour in this Steiner school. And, you know, unsurprisingly, if there's a whole account dedicated to it, those experiences were not positive, shall we say. And so I think it's about first laying all of your cards on the table. You know, yes, there are some positive things that we can take, but there are also some pretty dark elements to probably a lot of these different philosophies. And, you know, I think Waldorf is one which is often looked at because, you know, Rudolf Steiner, who was the founder of the Steiner-Waldorf movement, he had some pretty out there views. You know, he believed, for example, in some quite strange views around astronomy and where the Earth was, and he believed in dwarves and gnomes and, you know, all sorts of things which are quite interesting and quite strange from my perspective. But he also had some views which were, you know, pretty explicitly racist, and he talks about there being, you know, different, but evolution of different races and stuff, and, you know, things that we would I think see and recognize in some of the more abhorrent movements that we've had in the 20th century. And I don't think that's to say that there's no good that comes out of the Steiner-Waldorf movement, but I think we have to, if we're going to utilize ideas coming from these philosophies, we have to be honest with ourselves first, so that we can really engage critically with, okay, you know, where is this coming from? And I think that if you were to say, okay, well, we just don't have any educational method with any racist past, I mean, I think you really struggle to find any educational philosophy, even philosophies like Montessori, which were very much, you know, she talks a huge amount about peace and peace education in her work. But even then, you know, I've read lots of accounts of people who now have said, well, you know, my child has been in Montessori schools, and actually the Montessori school has been quite racist with regards to my child. And I've certainly been quite shocked. I remember finding a Montessori teacher once online, and, you know, it's the same thing of, well, I don't see colour because all children matter equally to me. And just thinking, like, you are writing this in, like, 2019. How is this possible? You know, so I think there's still, and I've seen again, you know, lots of discussions online around how, you know, there is within the Montessori community actually a lot of inbuilt and ingrained racism. So I think it is, we have to open our eyes first and really get a sense of, okay, what are we dealing with here? And then it's only when we have our eyes open to this that we can start thinking, okay, well, which of the parts we want to take forward and which of the parts we need to push back against and maybe fight for. And I think it's easier, you know, for me as a home educator, I can pick and choose. So, for example, I can take the rhythm element of the Waldorf approach, and I can take the, you know, moving at your child's pace element of the Montessori approach. I think it's probably more difficult if, for example, you are choosing to send your child to a Steiner school, because then I think you really do have to you know, spend a lot of energy engaging with that within the school community, ensuring that, for example, children have access to black crayons when they're in the kindergarten, because traditionally black isn't used in Waldorf schools until children are a certain age. And that can obviously be quite devastating for children who are trying to, you know, draw their hair, for example, and they don't have the right colours. So I think if you are within these communities, and I would also include homeschooling communities with that, I think we have to be open and honest, but I think we also need to really see where those problems are so we can start to counteract them. But I would say, I think the solution to this isn't just, okay, well, ignore all these wacky alternative approaches and put your child in mainstream school, because as we know, mainstream schools are horrifically racist as well.
Yeah.
You know, we don't teach black history, and there's been some really encouraging moves recently that I've seen to get more, you know, not just teaching things like slavery, but teaching black accomplishments and, you know, the wonderful impact that so many black communities have had on our country. So looking at, you know, a kind of a holistic history where we don't shy away from the atrocities we've committed, but we also don't just paint a whole group of people in terms of, well, these were the victims. I think, you know, and there have been lots of, you know, we know from statistics, we don't even need anecdotes, that Black children are much more likely to be excluded and expelled. And then we know that there is, big links to being expelled from school and then ending up involved in, kind of dangerous activities here in London, being at risk of gang violence and predation, and then, ending up in prison. And, so we still have very racist, I think, education system as a whole. So I think it's, it's not easy, because I don't think any of us, whether you're listening to this and your child goes to school, or whether you're listening to this as a homeschooler, I don't think any of us are exempt from this, deep soul searching and really important work of ensuring that our children's education is as actively anti-racist as it can be, really.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely not a either or situation. We should all be doing this regardless of our educational views and parenting views, whether we're peaceful parents or whatever type of parents we are. Even if you use the naughty step, you still, you still have to be engaging with anti-racist work and modeling anti-racist behavior. That's like, yeah, completely agree with you, that should be at the top of everything.
Yeah, I think so. And I think as home educators we have a special duty to do that, because even from things like choosing if you're not unschooling and maybe you're using curriculums with your child, so with Frida, at the moment I wouldn't say we're kind of fully unschooling. And I wonder if we will go more that way as she gets older, actually. That's probably another conversation for another day. So I will sometimes buy curriculums to use, not to kind of sit down and do with her day by day, but just as sort of inspiration for me, because they often include loads of interesting reading lists and activity ideas and things. And as someone who is enthusiastic but time poor, that works well. But, we have a duty, for example, to critically assess those things. And I've been really encouraged by lots of conversations in some of the groups that I'm in around, okay, can we, for example, find history curricula which are not actively racist, and are not just centering the white experience and the Western experience, but can we find, as well as talking about things like ancient Greece and ancient Rome, are we thinking about, ancient China, the Indus Valley, all of these amazing civilizations that get kind of written out of history. So I think there is a lot of work to be done. But even like kind of circling back to what we were saying about the privilege around things like unschooling, I think even if you are taking an unschooling approach, I think sometimes that can be interpreted as, fine, well, we won't teach our children anything until they've asked for it, which, as I'm sure you discussed with Lucy, that's not quite accurate. But I think, we can't even use things like unschooling as an excuse to not have difficult conversations with our children and not give them the education that they need in order to, learn about things like racism and sexism and, obviously in an age-appropriate way. I'm not suggesting that you take your four-year-old and start talking to him about genocide, but equally it's about, raising children who are going to be able to, become good citizens and good neighbours. But I think, to kind of go on a slight tangent here, I think it's really important to focus on our children's education and how we raise children. I think this very much, and it's really at the core of all I do. But I also think that it could be easy to say, well, I'm reading diverse books to my toddler, so I don't, that's doing all of the work what I need to be doing. And I think that one of the best and most important things we need to do with our children is modelling our own kind of, our own practice, whether that's reading books which challenge us, or whether that's actively talking about the donations that you make as a family, or whether it's going on protests, or and maybe it's all of those things. But I think that it's too easy to put all our hopes and dreams onto our children. And I think although raising children is a vital part of tackling injustice and inequality, I don't think the buck stops with them. I think that's unfair, and I think we need to be doing our own work just as importantly.
I think you're like the dream guest because you lead me on. You've basically led me on to every question in order of how I'm asking. First I want to say completely agree with you. And actually, the other day, the Conscious Kid shared a piece of research, and it was about it was research done on parents, and I actually didn't read it all, or at least didn't take it all in. But what I did take in was, it doesn't matter how many books you read, that doesn't make your children anti-racist. You modeling anti-racist behavior makes your kids anti-racist. And one of the examples given was going on protests and marches. And I had been, so my eldest, Anais, is just 3, and living in Brighton, it's a very white area. And so I do worry about that a lot, because she was born in London. We lived in London for almost my whole life. And which is a much more diverse place. And I wouldn't have had to think so hard about finding pockets of communities that are diverse or whatever. Anyway, we went on a march, on the Black Lives Matter march last week, and I did worry about taking her, and people were a bit sniffy about it, but I took her and I took Edie, and I went by myself with them both. And I'm not virtue signaling here, but I am glad that I did that, purely based on the fact that we've got an amazing picture from it, and it's a jumping off point to remind her that these are things that she should be doing and that we do as a family. So I just wanted to go on and talk about parenting game changers, because for me, the number one has been sites of mutual fulfillment, which obviously I talked to Lucy about last week, but also rhythms, which is the whole concept of rhythms I got everything from you, and keeping things really simple, especially when it comes to kind of toys, books, that less is more approach, but also just parenting style, weekends, that sort of thing. I think one of your recent Instagram posts was about weekends and kind of the expectations on weekends. And oh my goodness, yes. I think so many of us feel like we have to pack out our weekends and make them worthwhile. Really, that's just capitalism at work, making us feel that we have to be productive in every second of every day. What are some parenting game changers that you've come to, that you've discovered for yourself, but also ones that you just really wish you could tell all parents about?
Ooh, that's such a good question. I think one of the number one game changers, which I think leads on from what you were just saying about this kind of toxic productivity that we are made to feel, just allowing myself, when I'm able to just prioritize doing nothing or doing things that I want to do. And I think, you know, if you have young children, you're probably continually fighting kind of, you know, against a tide of toys everywhere and, you know, plates with toast crusts on and, you know, dishwasher or washing machine that continually needs replenishing or emptying. And I think there is always a job to do when you have a young child or more than one young child, and letting go of some of that pressure to just go, you know what, my daughter's playing happily, I'm not going to do any chores right now, I'm going to read. Like, that's much more valuable for me, and I think it's really valuable for her as well to see a mother who is able to prioritize her own pleasure over constantly having, you know, a dishcloth in her hand. So that's been a real game changer for me, I think, trying to actively find space in my day, especially as a homeschooling parent, because you're with your child all day. So we have after lunch a kind of parent instigated quiet time, and it is very much a kind of, you know, I'm sure my daughter would at some points maybe prefer it didn't happen. But it's really important for me, and it allows me to then go and be a good parent for the rest of the afternoon. So, you know, she can play quietly or she can listen to an audiobook, but that is a kind of, you know, depending on what day it is, it might be half an hour, it might be an hour, where I just get to lie on the sofa basically and just read my book. It's so good. And it's hard when you have, you know, a baby or a younger toddler, but it's something that even when Frida was little, I tried to do, even at just 10 minutes at a time, to try and really grow that muscle. And I'm really glad that I've done that because, it's allowed me to read some really excellent books recently, which I feel very grateful for. So that's been a good thing. I think also, so there's a book that I adore, which really, I think, both chimed with, I think in many ways, how I was parented, but really kind of made explicit to me how important being playful was with your children. And for me, that's been an enormous game changer. So the book is called Playful Parenting, and it's by someone called Lawrence Cohen. And he is just amazing. And actually, if you have children who are prone to worry and anxiety, he's also written a phenomenal book called The Opposite of Worry, which is all about using kind of playful parenting techniques to support your child into relaxing around some of their anxieties and worries. And he just, yeah, he is amazing. I really recommend his books. And I think just remembering and allowing myself to be playful, especially when, you know, those parenting moments where you can just start feeling that wave of frustration or anger rising up in you. I remember actually feeling like that yesterday evening. I was tired and I was trying to brush Frida's hair before she went to bed. And it's always, you know, it's always the same. I start brushing it and then she delightedly spins away and starts running. And at that point, I'm just like, oh, I've got stuff I want to do. I don't want to be arguing with you about brushing your hair. And, you know, I can really sense it really triggers me. I don't know why. There's something about it which really bothers me. And I could just feel that sense coming up. And sometimes I don't manage to catch myself, but this time I really managed to catch myself and just thought, you know, look, if I can either go two ways here, I can either start getting, you know, really like, oh, Frida, you just need to come here and, you know, let me do your hair, which doesn't help anyone because she then senses that frustration and responds in an even more, you know, triggering way. Or I can catch myself and try and be playful. And I can't even remember what I said. You know, I think I've pretended to be a Moomin character. And she's really into the Moomins at the moment. And then was like, oh, you know, Frida, you've taken your lovely silky hair away from me. And then, you know, she comes back and, you know, we brush her hair. And, you know, it's those moments where if you can catch yourself, it, for me, those playful moments are, yeah, it's what both helps life become smoother, but also it dissolves so many conflict points and just, I think, makes life more joyful and happier. And as a parent, for me, it has just been such a game changer trying to just remind myself, you know, yes, I can indulge myself into feeling cross and grumpy, but actually that's not going to make me feel any better. And it's sure as hell not going to make my daughter feel happier. Or I can bite my tongue and try and remember that actually just being playful for 30 seconds will then cheer us both up. And then the playfulness doesn't need to be forced anymore. It becomes natural. And we ended up, you know, I ended up brushing her hair, like I think 3 or 4 different Moomin characters. And yeah, it was fun and she was happy and relaxed, which is exactly what you want when your child is going to bed. So yeah.
I think there was a box out in your book about playful parenting, or I think you maybe referenced it a few times in kind of practical terms, things that you could do. And I'm ashamed to say that although I'm definitely a more naturally kind of playful parent than my husband, in that I will get right into her world and just in a, like, her kind of I don't know what the word is, really. It's a bit like improvisation. I'm very yes and with her, whereas Ollie's not as much. But I think that's just because Anais is very similar to me, and I played like that as a child. I was very had a really active imagination, which actually was told to me in you know, as if it was not a good thing when I was younger. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. But I've never really, when it gets to setting boundaries, not being a permissive parent, or triggering moments, yeah. I really struggle. And I've really pushed away from the moniker of being a peaceful parent and that whole approach, because I just feel like that's not for me, because I'm too feisty and like I feel the rage inside me, even if I don't show it too much, to be a peaceful parent. But actually what I was missing was just a bit of playfulness. Yeah. And I'm not saying that's easy. I definitely, yesterday was a hard day and I was really snappy. And you just have to kind of forgive yourself for that and move on, because you're human. But the playful, when I'm at my best, and probably only the past week, I've been using some of the examples that you put in your book. And oh my goodness, it's a bit fake it till you make it in a way.
Exactly.
it really works.
Yeah, and I think so much of that actually is peaceful parenting. I think there's this myth sometimes that you either are a peaceful parent or you're not. And I think that yes, some people are naturally more inclined, probably because of how they've been parented themselves, but actually so much of it is just resetting those, you know, those immediate responses that you give, those reactions. Mm. I think sometimes it is about faking it until you make it, and then you fake it enough times that suddenly you realize that you are responding in a way that feels playful without even really thinking about it.
That's so true. The thing that I'm really struggling with right now is praise. Mm. Oh, I really, really struggle not to give praise. Oh, it's so hard, because it feels so unnatural. But I mean, we could probably spend a whole podcast talking about why you shouldn't praise. But anyhow, I am not going to take up any more of your time, but I would really, before we leave, love to ask you what your signature dish is. Because I see your stories. I know you can cook.
Signature dish. That is a very tricky question. So if I'm having people round for dinner, I usually do a whole bunch of salads. That's usually my favourite thing to do. So maybe roast some veggies, toast some seeds, you know, get down the Ottolenghi cookbooks together. That tends to be what I do, because it's just so easy if you're having friends over. If it's just me, I think my signature dish is probably Marmite on toast.
That's my love language right there.
I ate so much Marmite on toast when I was pregnant with you. It's one of my favorite foods. I think it would probably be, you know, my up there with my absolute favorite meals.
Oh, I love it. I love that. I flipping love Marmite on toast. I haven't had my breakfast yet, so I think I'm gonna have that.
I think I might do the same.
Thank you so much for being part of the podcast. Where can everybody find you online?
They can find me. So I'm on Instagram at mightymother_. I have a free Facebook group for parents, which is A Beautiful Childhood, which you can come and hang out and chat. And I have a website called A Beautiful Childhood as well. But yeah, I mostly hang out on Instagram. So come and find me at Mighty Mother and say hello. I'd love to chat to you.
And your book, Extraordinary Parenting, is in all good bookshops.
It is. And yeah, if you like it, let me know. It still feels very surreal seeing people reading it and buying it. So I'm still in a complete honeymoon phase.